Hello, and welcome to Makeshift Stories. Thank you for listening. You can help us out by telling your friends about us and getting them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Now, open your imagination and take a journey into the improbable. Today's story, 180, Fission City, Part 1. Read by Mitchell 2. Somewhere and sometime, the truth may be stranger than you can ever imagine. Mr. Petrenko?
The young woman greeted me, recorder in one hand. I could see the first question in her excited brown eyes before she could verbalize it. Ms.?
Naomi Martell, please, just call me Naomi.
Okay then, Naomi. You are about to ask me, why am I still here? Living in a ghost town, on an inaccessible shore of a northern lake 60 degrees from the equator, where the mosquitoes outnumber the trees.
Was I that obvious?
Embarrassed, Naomi's cheeks reddened. It's the first question any rational person would ask me. I watched her reaction carefully, reminding myself that once I had the same enthusiasm, and once, like her, my face had been a smooth canvas that life had yet to erode lines of experience into. Why am I here, when the mine shut down 38 years ago? Why does an 89-year-old live alone outside a ghost town, 40 minutes by bush plane to the closest medical station? They're all good questions, and the right ones to ask. But the answer is complex. I hope you're not in a hurry. I already knew the answer. She and a male friend had flown in on a twin otter, which was probably older than both their ages combined. It was the same plane that had come once a week for the last 50 years. Now upgraded with modern turboprop engines, it only flew in once a month to drop supplies, or on the rare charter flight, like the one my two guests had arranged. They'd be picked up in a week or 10 days, weather permitting.
We came here specifically to do a story about you, so take all the time you want. The plane doesn't come back until next week.
Where are you staying?
The pilot gave us the key to the shed at the airstrip. They still keep it repaired. I know everything else is closed. Are you really the last person living in Fission City?
Something to drink? I offered distractedly, waiting for an unwelcome familiar sound outside to make an appearance. But it was obviously not the right time. There was nothing but the rustling of leaves in a light fall breeze. I make tea out of pine needles. It's got more vitamin C than 5 oranges and will clean out your sinuses if you've got a cold. Sorry, what's your name again? It's so rare that I need to use a name these days.
That's okay, I understand. It's Naomi. I'm a freelance writer, and my friend's name is Michael. He's a photographer. He's out scouting the town right now. Oh, I suppose we should have asked you first.
She was genuinely apologetic, which I appreciated. No apology necessary. There's no one there anymore, and I'm not the town's guardian. Far from it. I go there occasionally to scavenge building materials. So, where's this story going to be printed?
Not printed. We're going to post it online,
Naomi corrected.
Do you know about that kind of thing?
At first, the question insulted me. It assumed octogenarians had given up on the world and lived in some sort of nostalgic time warp. I had to remind myself that the question may have had more to do with my isolation than age. I haven't disconnected from the world, Miss Martell, although I can see how you must assume that. I have a portable satellite internet connection, but the cost is so high I use it very sparingly. It was a gift from the mayor when she finally closed the town office. It's how we connected through email. Although, I understand email is passé with your generation. But up here, text is still the cheapest way to connect. Fewer bits to transfer than memes and emoji. Naomi looked embarrassed again. Easy enough mistake to make. Who'd expect an 89-year-old hermit to be on the internet? I'm not living here to escape from the world. Quite the opposite. I'm here because I love the world so much. She let my last statement hang in silence, gathering significance before deciding how to respond. I understand, Mr. Petrenko. Which, from the confused expression, she obviously didn't. We were interrupted by the crunching of boots and the snapping of twigs under feet, more familiar with asphalt than a northern trail. She looked expectantly to the front door.
That'll be Michael, unless there's another person living around here,
the young woman joked nervously. It was not the sound I had been reluctantly anticipating, so I confirmed her guess. Bears, elk, coyotes, and radioactive spirits don't sound like rubber-soled boots. I smiled, but Naomi seemed to be taken back by my mention of ghosts. The inexperienced footsteps grew louder, then clunked noisily up the wooden steps I had salvaged from the town hall. There was a quick rap on the door. Please, come in. We were about to have some of my homemade pine needle tea, I invited, louder than I had spoken in months. It was strange hearing the sound of my voice. The door swung open, revealing a late 20s man with long, sandy hair pulled back into a ponytail, dressed in an unzipped yellow down jacket, revealing a dark blue plaid shirt, which looked like it had never been worn before. My eyes dropped down and found the pristine hiking boots, which had been the source of the noise. He had a camera bag slung over one shoulder.
This is Dimitro, Michael. Dimitro, this is my friend, the photographer, Michael.
Michael held out a hand for me to shake, forcing me to get stiffly to my feet. These days, any time I sat in one spot too long, my joints protested when I tried to move again. Naomi's friend had a strong grip, but hands which had never labored on anything more demanding than a keyboard. Michael, please sit while I get the tea ready.
Thanks, Dimitro.
He sat down hard on the hearth, next to my do-it-yourself rocker made of scavenged furniture from an abandoned house in town, which Naomi had elected to use.
I wandered through most of the old downtown and found a few great spots to shoot, he explained, putting his expensive-looking camera into his shoulder bag. But the light wasn't right. It's too late in the day. I really liked the old school. I think I'll spend a few hours going through it tomorrow. Is that where you went when you were a kid, Dimitro?
If only I was that young. The school wasn't built until I was 50. I don't think they would have accepted me as a student. Imagine, an old miner trying to tuck into a primary school desk. I laughed at the image, then pulled the strainer with the tea out of a pot of boiled water and poured it into three mismatched cups, also scavenged. I moved the cups to my tiny kitchen table and sat down on a stool closest to the wood stove. Tea's on. My visitors dutifully made their way over and sat down. Naomi lay her recorder on the old yellow Formica table, the fruit of an early scavenge run through an abandoned housing project. People tended to take only things that would fit in the plane, and the Twin Otter, which was the last remaining air service before everything closed, had limited cargo space. Ground shipping across the lake on a temporary winter ice road wasn't an option by then, so most people simply abandoned larger possessions. I had outfitted myself quite nicely before nature had begun to reclaim the detritus of almost half a century of human occupation. Naomi didn't turn her recorder on this time. She appeared to have given up on the idea that I was going to allow an interview at our first meeting. Instead, she picked up her cup, careful not to burn her fingers, and sniffed at the steaming green liquid.
"Hey, this smells pretty good."
She seemed surprised and took a tentative sip. "I'm glad you like it. Tea is a good way to get to know each other. After all, if you want to know about my life, then I think it's only fair you tell me a bit about who you are before we start. Fair enough?" Naomi looked quizzically at Michael, who hesitated before consenting.
"Well, you already know why we're here. I'm a freelance writer and Michael's a photographer. We're working on a series of stories about abandoned mining towns and, well, Fission City is unique. It's not just another exhausted gold or copper mine. It supplied reactor fuel and uranium for Cold War research."
I nodded thoughtfully. "And what about yourselves?"
Right. Michael and I graduated from the same college program, but there's not many jobs out there these days for young people starting out. So we created our own online business, making multimedia content.
"I know what it's like, not being able to find work. That's how I ended up here," I noted, remembering how hard things had been for me after the war.
"Your story, Dimitro, will be our pilot project. We needed something unique to attract an audience. There's growing interest in the Cold War era we are hoping to capitalize on. Fission City's role in the beginnings of the nuclear industry is what interests us. That and your insistence on living alone in such a remote northern location."
"So, you're not getting paid?" Michael, who had been unconsciously making circles with a forefinger around a chip in the table's formica, looked up.
"No. We raised the money for this trip through an online FundMe campaign. The people who supported us will get the enhanced version of the story. Photos, video, audio, additional background, and that kind of thing."
"It's the only way to get anywhere today. You need to build an audience,"
Naomi added anxiously.
"There are no jobs. You have to make your own. The only alternative is doing underpaid gigs for some rideshare or something."
"So, if I decide not to be interviewed?" Both looked tense and crestfallen, as if they had just been dealt a two of clubs instead of an ace. "So, the death of Fission City has become a unique opportunity." I laughed at the irony. "At least for those desperate and foolish enough to get here. I like your spirit. I hope I live up to your expectations." I smiled and watched their apprehension slip away. "Finish your tea, and we'll start tomorrow. You'll need to be on the trail back to town well before sunset."
"We've got headlamps."
Michael pointed to his camera bag. "Yes, yes, but until you know the trails better, you should only travel in daylight. It's easy to get lost. Also, you'll need time to set up at the airstrip. There are black bears around here, and it hasn't been a good season for berries. So, you'll need to store your food away from that shed where you're sleeping. It might look solid, and I don't want to scare you, but the bears get in there all the time. I'd put all your food in a pack and string it about 15 feet off the ground on the old steel radio tower. They can't climb that."
"Thanks for the tip."
Naomi looked at Michael nervously.
"Maybe we should get going. What time tomorrow, Dimitro?"
"I don't use a watch anymore. I'm up with the sun. So, any time after that." I sat on the porch and watched them wind their way back down the overgrown road, then disappear behind the skeleton of my truck, which two aspen trees had turned into a large, raised garden box by taking root in its rusted-out flatbed. The sun was just a memory in the evening sky, its scarlet reflection fading on the clouds gathered at the horizon, and above them, the first stars of the night had begun to appear when I heard the sound I had been waiting for all day. It came from the direction of the old road, which wound its way from the scar in the earth that had been the mine to the decayed corpse of the town. Through the trees, I could see the familiar ghostly blue light moving. It stopped for a moment, as if trying to decide, then continued on its way toward town. I was thankful for the break, and slept better that night than I had in decades. I had breakfast on when Naomi and Michael arrived. Fried potatoes I grew in the garden I had cleared behind the house, and smoked northern pike from the lake. This time, I noted Naomi was armed with a fancy audio recorder and large headphones. "Have you had breakfast? I can make more," I offered.
"No, we've eaten. And thanks for the tip about the bears. We heard something outside the shed last night."
Naomi was trying to sound calm as she sat down at the table and began to fuss with her gear. "Did it stay long?"
"Wandered around a bit. We had our pepper spray ready,"
Michael boasted, dropping a heavy-looking camera bag on the floor.
"We're hoping to get a portrait of you outside in the morning light in front of your house or that old truck down the road."
I doubt the pepper spray would have worked. The words were out of my mouth before I could stop them.
"The stuff has really improved since your day, Dimitro. It'll fend off a grizzly. You said there are only black bears, so we should be okay."
But it wasn't the bears I was worried about. I knew I would eventually have to tell them. They just didn't seem ready, and I had no control over how things might roll out.
"We've brought coffee."
Naomi, changing the subject, produced a vacuum-sealed bag and handed it to me. "Thank you. I haven't had coffee in years, I suppose." After breakfast, we went outside. Michael positioned me on the steps while Naomi held a circular reflector up to fill in the light or something. Once Michael was happy, he showed me the pictures on a little screen embedded in the back of his camera. Initially, I was shocked at the ancient, weathered figure staring back at me. I suppose I shouldn't have been. I am almost 90, but I rarely saw myself so objectively. I only knew I felt like the same person who had come here all those decades ago. My guests only saw my exterior, an ancient, decaying frame, like every other human-made thing abandoned in Fission City. Satisfied, Michael left to document what he called context, and Naomi and I went back inside to the yellow kitchen table, where she had finished setting up what, to me, was quite an elaborate recording system.
"We may make part of this into a podcast. Do you know what those are?"
Naomi inquired. "No. Is that some kind of fishing reel?" She immediately picked up on the sarcasm.
"Oh, right. I forgot you have Satlink."
I cut open the bag of coffee, releasing the intoxicating aroma of roasted beans, then put the grinds into a pot of boiling water and waited a few moments before straining the result into two cups. "Where do you want me to start?"
"At the beginning. Why you came here. That kind of thing. Just wait. Okay, I'm recording."
She pulled the big headphones over her ears, adjusted something, then motioned for me to start. I leaned back in my chair and sipped at the coffee, enjoying the rare treat, which started to stimulate many old memories. Where to start? Have you heard of the atomic age, Naomi?
No. Was that a coffee shop or something in town?
It was Naomi's turn at sarcasm. I was beginning to like her. Well, let's start there. I was 15 in 1946 when the first atomic bombs were dropped. That's what people claimed was the beginning of the atomic age. I don't know. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But the world got obsessed with the power of the atom. I didn't know much about it back then. I had dropped out of school and was doing odd jobs around town to help make ends meet. Painting fences, hauling stuff, that kind of thing. I would do anything as long as I got paid. But As the military began to demobilize at the end of the war, people came home, and there wasn't a shortage of guys to do stuff anymore. So, by the time I was 18, that kind of work had mostly dried up, and I had to look elsewhere. There were jobs, sure enough, but for most of them, you needed to have a trade or have a college diploma. I didn't have either, and not being a vet, there wasn't much chance of getting a loan or apprenticing. I looked up north, where I'd heard new mines were opening. So, at 19, I found myself in a company town, working in a hard rock nickel mine, loading ore into hoppers. It didn't pay a lot, but it was work, and it was all I was going to get. At that time, the papers were full of stuff about the Soviets building their own atomic bombs, and there was a rumor they were even building atomic power stations. So were we, and that's kind of crazy when you think about it. The nuclear genie had escaped its bottle and was going to change everything. Electricity was going to come from the atom, come from thousands of nuclear power stations. No one thought about the consequences. The future was atomic, as long as the Soviets didn't blow us up before we got there. Even the radio shows I listened to back then had characters working in atomics with plots built around the miracle some radioactive isotope would give the world. So of course, when I heard about a new mine opening, which was going to supply all the uranium the free world could use, I wanted to work there. Plus, the money was way better than anything I could get where I was. Is this the kind of stuff you're interested in? I took a break to take another sip of the coffee before it cooled.
You're doing great, Dimitro.
Okay then. I got to Fission City in 1952. I was 21, and thinking this was where the future lay. They were still building the mine, and I got on as a general laborer, doing whatever was necessary around the construction sites. They were building a whole new town, schools, movie theater, airstrip, the whole nine yards. It was exciting, heady times, and everyone was in a rush. The USSR's Obninsk nuclear power plant in Science City was nearing completion, or so the intel said, which caused a panic to get atomic plants up and going here. We couldn't lag behind the Soviets, so the mine was rushed into production. One of the site supervisors found out I had worked in hard rock before. He liked me, and gave me a job underground. They trained me to operate a rock splitter. I was ecstatic, even started making enough money to send back home. I was on top of the world, and I had a plan. I was going to work hard and save enough to retire young, then leave. I figured in 20 years I'd be 41 and free. That would have been 1972. The fact I was planning to leave perked Naomi's interest.
So, you never intended to stay here all your life. What happened?
I took a long draw on my coffee, using the time to assemble my thoughts. How could I explain in a way that was believable to someone who hadn't experienced it? I was caught in the middle of that quandary when Naomi touched my arm.
Sorry, you seem to be lost. Are you okay?
Of course I am, I growled, assuming she thought I had been overtaken by age-related dementia or something, when, in fact, too many thoughts were rolling through my head to focus on one. Sorry, bad memories.
Do you want to stop?
No, let's keep going a bit longer. Today, tomorrow, it makes no difference. The past has already happened, and its control of the present can't be changed. Anyway, I had been working underground for about 6 years when the Castro Revolution in Cuba happened and tensions were high between the Soviets and us. It felt like we were on the edge of some big cataclysm with the communists in the Caribbean 60 miles from Florida. I'm not sure if you can imagine the fear that it caused. The world seemed like it might come to an end at any moment. That was the dead of winter, January 1959. At that time of year, the sun barely edges over the southern horizon for 3 or 4 hours a day, and it was one of those long winter nights when my life completely changed. The shift manager had asked me to stay behind to work a new, promising seam with the hydraulic rock drill. He offered double time, plus it was dark and minus 35 Fahrenheit on the surface. It was a no-brainer. I would have been an idiot not to accept. Okay, we were breaking every safety regulation in the book, but our shift hadn't been meeting quota. We needed to know the quality of the new vein of uranium we were about to work. And I was going to get the samples. Easy work while the rest of my shift sat in a bar drinking their wages. We agreed I'd put the samples into a special bucket, which the shift manager would come in early to winch to the surface. I was working on the last core when the drill jammed in the borehole. Smoke poured out of the thing's clutch. It was as if the rock had decided enough was enough and clamped down on the hollow bit. I shut it down and ran to the water station to fill a bucket to cool the machine off. I wasn't rated for that drill, so if I damaged it, both the shift manager's and my job were on the line. The lights started to flicker as I struggled back to the rock face with the heavy pail. The power did that sometimes, but it was a Friday night, and there shouldn't have been enough load on the grid to cause problems. As I negotiated the last turn, I saw a blue glow emanating from the rock face and an odd noise, which, had there been anyone else in the mine, I would have taken for mumbling. At first, I thought the glow might be Cherenkov radiation. Then I saw it, a vague silhouette moving in front of the rock face, moving toward me, enticing me to it. I wanted to run, but I was frozen in place, like my feet had become embedded in the rock. Michael's unexpected footsteps outside interrupted my thoughts. He burst through the door unannounced.
Hey, Naomi, Dimitro, there's a big storm coming. We gotta get back to the shed.
I felt as helpless as I had all those years ago in the mine as I watched them rush away. There was nothing I could do but ensure everything was ready for what would inevitably happen next.
Makeshift Stories is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB Financial. To listen to other great APN podcasts such as Read Along, a mini book club for your ears, please head over to albertapodcastnetwork.com. This episode is brought to you by ATB. Working in the arts means income can be as varied as a time signature or brushstroke. ATB's branch for arts and culture was built for artists so you can do your banking in a way that works for you, with a community of like-minded people. It's just one more way ATB will always be more than a bank. Visit atb.com/thebranch to find out how ATB's Branch for Arts and Culture can support your career in the arts. Learn more at atb.ca. The Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB, is happy to be partnering with Seat Giant to offer you a deal on tickets to major sporting events, big concerts, popular theater throughout North America, and more. Whether you're at home or on vacation, check Seat Giant for tickets to the hottest theater, music, and sports events such as The Wailers or A Chorus Line. Visit seatgiant.ca to find tickets. Use the promo code APN at checkout to get 5% off your purchase. You'll save a bit, and the network gets a little cut of that purchase too. Makeshift Stories is released twice a month, usually around the 1st and the 15th. Today's story was written by Alan V. Hare and read by Mitchell Tu. Opening and closing music was composed and recorded by David Hume. You can find more about David at davidhume.me. We want your feedback, so please send us an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. You can help us out by telling your friends about us and getting them to head over to Apple Podcasts or their favorite podcast provider to subscribe. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons non-commercial attribution, no derivative license, which means you are free to share our stories. Just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.